Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week, we present Clayton Swisher, author and Middle East analyst, who assesses the continuing Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the urgent need for a constructive U.S. role in the post-election period. Michael Clare, director of the Peace and World Security Studies Program at Hampshire College, who takes a critical look at the links between U.S. foreign policy and America's dependence on imported oil. And Leslie Kagan, National Coordinator of United for Peace and Justice, who discusses the role of the peace movement after the November 2nd U.S. presidential election. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Christian Science Monitor reports that a huge swarm of locusts has overtaken West Africa. The problem is much worse than usual, as robust rains have allowed locusts to multiply at an alarming rate. Some locust swarms are now more than 40 miles long. In coming months, the locust swarms are threatening to move into North Africa and could migrate across the Mediterranean into Italy. Every day, locusts eat their weight in food, devastating what could have been a bumper crop for West Africa. If the rains spread to nations like Morocco, Libya, or Algeria, the fear is that the size of locust swarms could explode in 2 or 3 years to rival those of the late 1980s, which caused widespread famine in Africa. Officials with the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization in Rome warned of a locust outbreak a year ago, but they received only $14 million from donor countries to make preparations. Jan England, a top UN humanitarian official, says there are high stakes in the weeks ahead in fighting the locusts. If not checked, warned England, the swarms could wreak havoc more devastating than Africa's recent wars, including the Darfur conflict in the Sudan. The BBC reports that Indonesian prosecutors charged Abu Bakar Bashir, the spiritual leader of the Islamic group Jamaah Islamiyah, as being the mastermind behind the 2002 Bali bombing. That's the one that killed over 200 people, including many foreign tourists. In recent days, Bashir has also been charged with ordering the 2003 bombing of the Marriott Hotel in Jakarta. He was in jail at the time and denies any responsibility for the bombing. In fact, Bashir has been in and out of Indonesian jail since the 2002 bombing of the Bali nightclub. In September 2003, he was convicted of sedition, but that charge was later overturned on appeal. Moreover, the Islamic group Jamaah Islamiyah was blamed for the September the 10th car bombing of the Australian embassy in Jakarta. Prosecutors say that Amrozi, one of those convicted of the Bali bombing, asked for Bashir's permission to carry out the terror attack. Authorities also say that Bashir was aware of the bombing and did nothing to stop it. Further, more than half of the identified Bali bombers had graduated from the Islamic boarding school that Bashir ran until he was arrested 2 years ago. Indonesia's new president, Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, has promised to clamp down on violent militants. Many will view progress of this trial as indicative of his commitment to that aim. In early October, Mexican activists marched along the border with the United States to protest a decade-long immigration crackdown by the U.S. Border Patrol that they say has resulted in the deaths of 2,000 migrants since 1998. According to the Associated Press, Operation Gatekeeper was started on October 1, 1994, to stop the flow of Latino immigrants into San Diego, California, from neighboring Tijuana. The Border Patrol has doubled the number of agents in the district, built a huge fence, and installed floodlights. Critics say the policy has only forced migrants to cross the border inland, often in hot deserts, causing more immigrants to die whilst crossing the border. Claudia Smith of the California Rural Legal Assistance Foundation, who marched with the protesters, observed, "Gatekeeper has been a huge political success because it has pushed things out of public view." Yet, potential Mexican migrants are not deterred by the border crackdown. Felix Cruz plans to make a 35-mile hike through the mountains around San Diego. He used to make $700 a week working construction in California's affluent Orange County. The chance of steady work and comparatively good wages will continue to draw thousands of immigrants across the border, regardless of the risks or of the security crackdown. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Rees.
This week's program was produced prior to knowing the results of the November 2nd presidential election. However, the interviews we present here cover the critical issues which will confront whoever wins the White House. Our first segment assesses the ongoing violence in the Middle East. While America is focused on the war in Iraq and the threat of international terrorism, the bloody conflict between Israelis and Palestinians continues without any serious effort by the U.S. or other nations to renew the failed peace process. While members of Hamas and other militant Palestinian groups carry out attacks against Israeli settlements and civilian targets, the Israeli military continues to assassinate leaders of armed Palestinian groups, destroy civilian houses, and erect a controversial security barrier dividing Israel from the occupied territories. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon plans to go forward with the withdrawal of 8,000 settlers from the Israeli-occupied Gaza Strip, while making permanent some large settlements in the West Bank. But few observers expect that the Israeli leader's unilateral action, without negotiations with the Palestinians, can lead to peace. Around the world, and especially in the Middle East, the continuing conflict between Israelis and Palestinians, and U.S. support for Israel, exacerbates already dangerous hatred toward America and aids terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda in recruiting new members. Clayton Swisher is a former Marine reservist, federal investigator, and a Middle East analyst whose new book is titled The Truth About Camp David. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Swisher about the continuing Israeli-Palestinian conflict and why he feels it is urgent for the U.S. to aggressively pursue renewed Middle East peace talks.
There are two occupations that are foremost in the minds of the Arab and Muslim world right now. The first is the American occupation of Iraq. And before that, of course, which for the last 37 years since the 1967 war in the region, is the Israeli occupation of the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and the Golan Heights. Now, in terms of the Bush administration's objective of preaching and bringing liberty and freedom to the Arab and Muslim world, none of those objectives are found believable in that region until we address the longstanding claims between Israelis and Palestinians and Israelis and Syrians. And either administration, regardless of the outcome of the election, is going to have to pick up with this. Why? Because this is recognized widely as one of the leading drivers of recruits to bin Ladenism. And so it goes round robin in many ways between Iraq and a war on terror, all the while it undermines our ability to sell our country and our values abroad.
How does the Israeli-Palestinian conflict feed into those who are attracted to movements such as Al-Qaeda that have declared war on the West and the United States in particular?
Well, it feeds into bin Laden's ideology of fighting a defensive jihad, and that is our policies are seen as attacking Islam, whether it be the holy sites in the Holy Land through our proxy, which they consider our proxy Israel, or our surrounding of mosques in Iraq and places like Najaf. I mean, there's absolute linkage, and what bin Laden seizes on is for years, he's seized on our support for Israel and our unqualified support for their military reprisals and what we saw recently this year, for example, with President Bush signing a letter condoning the growth of Jewish settlements in the occupied territories. These are actions, provocations they see in their eyes, and they deeply undermine our ability to say that we don't stand for conquest of land and that we stand for the freedom and liberation of Arabs and Muslims. It's betraying our ethos when we tolerate one on the Israeli-Palestinian front and allow this behavior to continue, and where we say in Iraq we don't stand for these things. So they're contradictions that need to be worked out, and they won't go away with our election. In fact, they'll be for either candidate to deal with.
Clayton, I wanted to ask you, how best do you see to revive the peace process in the post-election period?
Well, that's an excellent question. I mean, we have two dilemmas here. On the one hand, we had excessive engagement by the Clinton administration, and you had a very committed team that had different versions in their mind of what an ultimate endgame solution would look like. This was the first time that they were discussing these things. You had some that believed the Palestinians should receive, as Egypt and Jordan did, 100% of the land, and others who thought that the Palestinians weren't entitled to it. You had an ideological debate within the Clinton administration. This is not exclusive to Republicans or Democrats. It just happened in the Clinton administration. But you had excessive engagement, while at the same time you had excessive deferral to the negotiating advice of an Israeli prime minister, who happened to be a Labor prime minister, Ehud Barak. Under the Bush administration, we saw excessive disengagement, And we saw the same ideological debates, though more siding with the Israelis in this particular instance. And while we had excessive disengagement, we also had the same deferral to the negotiating wisdom of the current sitting Israeli prime minister. This one happened to be Likud. The constant in all these, Scott, is whether disengagement or excessive engagement, is the constant deferral to the sitting Israeli government. The U.S. needs to act with independent thought with our own national security interests in mind. In fact, after 9/11, this should be readily apparent to any, and it is in fact to many, national security veterans in this town. Just it's hard to say for a politician. We have to do what's best in our interests. And you know what? Whatever president does broker an agreement between Israelis and Palestinians, and one has to keep in mind, the Israelis will be very thankful to that person, maybe not in the short term, but in the long term. If we are their true friend and ally, you know, true friends take their friends aside when they're about to step off a cliff. Well, the past 4 years of this intifada have been very hard on both sides. From the years 1997 to 2000, there were 12 Israeli killed. You know, since the intifada began, we've had over 1,300 Israelis killed and 3,500 Palestinians killed. Negotiations is the only way to the endgame two-state solution. Either Democrat or Republican are going to have to pick a policy option, but what I would recommend is go somewhere in between the excessive engagement, excessive disengagement, and most important, to start acting again with independent thought. Find, explain, define the endgame and move towards it. Don't be afraid to set down our own parameters. And fortunately, the Clinton administration broke this taboo, so there's cover for whoever comes in to move towards this endgame. Pressuring Israel has become, by virtue of our history with them and by virtue of a lot of the cheerleading from the lobbying groups, has become something of a taboo. It's slowly breaking, though. I think where in the 1980s, the role of AIPAC and other pro-Israel groups were very strong. I think that that's starting to sort of wean, and other voices of moderation are emerging.
That was Clayton Swisher, former Marine reservist, federal investigator, and a Middle East analyst. His book is titled The Truth About Camp David, The Untold Story About the Collapse of the Middle East Peace Process, published by Nation Books. Whether or not one believes that Iraq's oil is a fundamental reason for the U.S. war there, it's undeniable that U.S. access to cheap Middle Eastern oil has been essential to powering the American and world economies. Professor Michael Clare is director of the Peace and World Security Studies Program at Hampshire College in Massachusetts, and an authority on foreign policy and national security. His newest book is titled Blood and Oil: The Dangers and Consequences of America's Petroleum Dependency, in which he delineates the key role of oil in guiding U.S. foreign policy in the past and present. Ultimately, he writes, the cost of oil will be measured in blood, the blood of American soldiers who die in combat, the blood of the many other casualties of oil-related violence, including the victims of terrorism. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Professor Clare about the historical links between access to imported oil and U.S. foreign policy, and why he believes it is essential for the U.S. to separate energy policy from its security commitments.
The history of U.S. involvement over oil, international oil, began in World War II, when President Roosevelt determined that the United States, which up until that time had been the world's number one producer of petroleum, was going to begin to run out of its own oil after the end of World War II. And he was very worried about the fact that we'd become more dependent on imported oil. And so he decided that the United States had to have a protectorate of sorts over Saudi Arabia, which he saw as the major future supplier of America's oil. We'd have to have a military alliance there so that the United States could protect the flow of oil from the Persian Gulf. And so it was Roosevelt who established the U.S. alliance with the Saudi Arabian royal family. And that alliance has been nurtured by every American president since. And it has been U.S. policy to back up the royal family and protect it by providing arms and ammunition and military advisors and, when necessary, U.S. troops. So the first Persian Gulf War really started when Iraq invaded Kuwait in August 1990, and President Bush Sr. told the country on August 8th of that year that the United States had a vested interest in Saudi Arabia and we would use military force if need be to protect Saudi Arabia. That was the beginning of Operation Desert Storm.
You say in your book that one way out of this predicament of depending on a finite resource is to separate energy policy from our security commitments. But how do you think the U.S. can get to that point?
Well, certainly we can't do that if we keep on consuming more and more imported petroleum, which is the case now. Under the Bush-Cheney energy plan announced in 2001, the U.S. is destined to rely ever increasingly on imported petroleum, especially from the Middle East. If that's the path we follow, then we're going to have very little freedom in the matter. The only way to reduce our embrace of the Saudi royal family is to reduce our need for oil, and that means being much more prudent in our daily use of petroleum by driving less miles or choosing vehicles that are more fuel efficient. And only in that way will we have the freedom of action to say no to the royal family when they say do this or do that or come here or send over troops to protect us. That's really the only way.
I just saw part of a movie about oil. I think most Americans think of oil that's converted to gasoline to run vehicles or used in power plants. But the movie talked about how oil powers farm machinery to plant and harvest crops, and fertilizer is petroleum-based, and then the crops are transported to consumers in oil-dependent vehicles. And then, of course, plastics are made from oil, and it goes on and on. Reducing its use would change our whole culture.
This is true. We are very heavily dependent on petroleum for a wide range of economic activities. But 70%, about 70% of our oil usage is for transportation. That includes mainly cars, trucks, and buses, but also airplanes and ships and diesel railroads. But mostly it's vehicles. So in that area, in that 70% where we really have to concentrate if we're going to reduce our dependence on petroleum, it's going to be much harder to reduce the other uses, which include home heating as well, which is a very important part of, especially here in New England, where I am, most home heating is provided by heavy oil. But the biggest amount of conservation is going to have to come in vehicles, because that's where you really can make a difference. If we drive vehicles that are twice as fuel efficient as the ones we're driving now on average, we'd need half as much petroleum as we use.
We've talked about a lot of negative trends. Do you see signs of anything that's moving in the right direction?
Well, it's hard to find positives because there are so many negatives. We haven't spoken about the environment, for example, but it's very clear that all of the oil we're consuming, burning it up and pumping out the waste, the carbon dioxide through the exhausts of our cars, is contributing to the buildup of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and speeding the global climate change that we've been hearing about. So that's certainly going to be forcing us as we go into the future and the climate deteriorates, that's going to force us to make substantial changes in our behavior. There's no doubt in my mind about that. And I do think that young people, my students in my classes, undergraduates in their late teens and early 20s, are much more aware of this than older generations are, because they're well aware that, you know, they're going to be on this planet another 50 years or so. And if we don't change our behavior now, the environment is going to be much worse in 50 years than it is today. So I think they're going to be the agents of change in this area.
That was Michael Clare, director of the Peace and World Security Studies Program at Hampshire College. His latest book is titled Blood and Oil: The Dangers and Consequences of America's Petroleum Dependency. For more information, call the program at area code 413-559-5367 or visit their website at pawss.hampshire.edu. In the months before the Bush administration launched their invasion of Iraq, a powerful international peace movement organized to oppose the impending war. During global protests February 15, 2003, some 10 million people in more than 600 cities marched to oppose President Bush's preemptive war plan. The New York Times wrote at the time that George Bush had met the other superpower, world opinion. After the Iraq War began, organizers continued to mobilize opposition in the U.S. and around the world, putting pressure on the governments of Spain, Italy, and Britain that had signed on to the war. During the Republican National Convention, held in New York City in August, an estimated 500,000 people marched to oppose the war and the Bush agenda. Many in the peace movement believe that no matter who sits in the White House after the November election, the U.S. occupation of Iraq will continue to cause death and destruction and may likely escalate through the deployment of thousands more American troops. The largest anti-war coalition in the United States is United for Peace and Justice. The group's national coordinator, Leslie Kagan, has been in the forefront of peace and social justice organizing since the Vietnam War, and had a leading role in organizing many of the nation's largest demonstrations. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Kagan about the role of the peace movement after the U.S. presidential election.
Well, it's very clear that the war in Iraq and the occupation in Iraq is not about to end. Regardless of who's in the White House come January, this war and the occupation, nobody's put forth any plans or any concrete proposals that would indicate a speedy, let alone an immediate, withdrawal of U.S. troops. And that remains the consistent position of the anti-war movement in this country and around the world, and that is that not only that this war never should have happened, it was obviously based on a pack of lies, but that it needs to end, and that the quickest way to resolve things in Iraq is to get the U.S. troops out of there. So the work of the anti-war movement in this country and as a global force, we need to carry on. We need to keep doing all of the, not only the mobilizing, but the organizing work. For instance, we've been talking a lot in United for Peace and Justice about moving into a period over the next several months of really very systematically reaching out to the people we haven't spoken to yet, both to win over more people to the anti-war position, but then also to help people in their own settings, in their own neighborhoods, at schools, at workplaces, in religious institutions, wherever they are, to find ways to express their anti-war sentiment, whether that's, you know, putting a bumper sticker on their car or passing a resolution at their union or at their city council or whatever it might be. But really the neighborhood based, the community based and the workplace based organizing to strengthen the anti-war sentiment and to make more visible and articulate the anti-war feelings in this country.
Leslie Kagan, during the closing weeks of the election campaign, there was quite a bit more discussion of the possibility of a military draft, and that came along with discussion of personnel shortages at the Pentagon, the idea that more troops may be deployed in the coming year. Although both candidates say they have no intention of reinstituting the military draft, what's your view, and how big an issue do you think this is going to be?
Well, I think this could be a very big issue. Candidates often say things while they're running for office, and then their positions change the minute they're elected. So it's great to see them saying there'll be no draft, but who knows? If, in fact, the leadership, quote, leadership of the United States remains committed to keeping a military presence in Iraq, and at the same time, there's another military issue, a confrontation someplace else in the world, and the Pentagon or the State Department or the White House believe that troops need to be sent there, I don't know that they have the wherewithal to cover that. So I think that the issue of, you know, whether or not there's going to be a reinstatement of the draft in this country, it's not crazy that people are worried about that. I think we do need to be worried about that, and we do need to fight against it. And we also need to address all of the issues around recruitment. Who are the targets that the military now goes after, you know, to recruit into the armed services. You know, clearly a disproportionately high number of people of color are recruited in, partially because they don't have jobs other places. So a lot of people go into the armed services or into the reserves thinking that that's a good career move, never expecting that they were going to go, you know, be asked to fight in Iraq or any place else. Anyway, the point is that it's not at all clear to me that just because people running for office now are saying or have been saying that there would be no draft, that 6 months, a year, 2 years down the road, that they wouldn't decide to go for a draft.
Leslie Kagan, has the peace movement or is the peace movement articulating some kind of practical set of demands for the U.S. to pursue a different policy to end the war that
right.
could be translated into civic action, as you've been talking about on the street level, as well as maybe even taking the form of legislation before Congress?
Right. That's a great question. We are actually, we as United for Peace and Justice, we're in a process right now, and it will probably take another few weeks to you know, to have a finished product, where we're trying to hammer out a set of what we would call transitional demands. That is, our main demand is to end the occupation and bring the troops home. We want to hammer out and put on the table, whether it's, you know, another Bush administration or a new Kerry administration, a set of concrete steps that could be taken, concrete commitments that need to be made. For instance, just one that comes off the top of my head right now is that it seems as if the U.S. government is now planning to have 14 permanent military bases in Iraq. One of our demands would be to not go ahead with the building of these 14 military bases, that's an inappropriate way to begin to move toward bringing our troops out of Iraq. But to articulate a series of very concrete steps that that Washington would need to take in order to move toward a final resolution of this problem, and that is bringing the troops home.
That was Leslie Kagan, National Coordinator with United for Peace and Justice. Contact United for Peace at area code 212-868-5545 or visit their website at www.unitedforpeace.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Nigel Reese, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruben Abreu.